That brings us to the final chapter of the unit, which I probably just have time for. That reminds me to remind you that Monday, you need to make sure you bring a Scantron. Remember, I'm not going to have the Scantron forms. We don't give them away anymore. I think they sell packets of six for something like a buck. Make sure you have one that day, though. In the opening slide here of this fourth chapter, we have a cartoon of the glassware that made up the experimental apparatus in a famous experiment that was first done in the 50s. It's called the Miller-Urey experiment, but you don't have to know the name. But this experiment was set up to demonstrate that the things that organisms are made out of, the macromolecules, or even more basically, the building blocks that those macromolecules are made out of, the subunits, which didn't exist already in early Earth, could easily have come into existence for ordinary chemical reasons given Earth's early conditions. And this all boils down to what we keep saying about cell theory, right? Cell theory says that cells come only from pre-existing cells. That's the way it's been for billions of years. Cells don't just pop into existence. They come from pre-existing cells. But obviously, there must have been some original cells that didn't come from pre-existing cells, right? They came from the stuff cells are made out of, molecules. Well, the point is, where did those molecules come from? You can't imagine the cell, the first cells coming into existence, until you first imagine the molecules being there to make the cells. And what you need to appreciate here is that there's almost a billion years of Earth history at the beginning before there was any life. 800 million years or so of pre-life Earth, which is called the Hadean Aeon, meaning hell-like because its conditions were very, very hot. Totally different from how they are today. But no organisms at all for almost a billion years. And during that time, there was a change in chemistry, new molecules being produced. That's what this is trying to demonstrate, how it could have happened. So you have the hellishly hot ocean here with simple compounds that we're pretty sure existed, but not the ones that organisms are made out of. And you have an atmosphere here in a different bulb fitted with electrodes that you can occasionally spark to mimic lightning. Now, the real experiment, the actual Earth, had 800 million years to work with, which is unimaginably long from our point of view. Right, 100 years seems like a long time, effectively zero compared to 800 million years. Well, you don't have to run this experiment for close to that. You just run it for a couple weeks and then sample what you have, and you see that just from these ordinary run-of-the-mill molecules and the lightning and the heat, you eventually get organic compounds that are the building blocks of the things cells are made out of without any life involved. Well, I just used the word organic. We're on slide 2 now. These are organic compounds, but I need to talk about this word organic for a minute. For most of human history, meaning just until fairly recently, we thought incorrectly that the stuff that organisms are made out of is somehow fundamentally different from the stuff that non-living things are made out of. And then we therefore thought that it was impossible chemically to make the things that are things that organisms are made out of using stuff from non-living sources. Therefore, we called this so-called special stuff that organisms are made out of organic material. It comes from the same root as organism itself. All right, that's what organic means. I mean, that's why it was given that name originally. Now, we were wrong about that, and now it's pretty routine thing to make organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. But we couldn't do that for a long time and thought it was impossible. That's why the word exists. And by the way, this use of organic is in chemistry. It has nothing to do with the food use of organic, like in a grocery store. That ranges from meaningless to meaningful, depending on who's using the word. But whether it's meaningful or not, those are not at all related to the chemical definition of organic. Organic in chemistry loosely means carbon-containing. You've probably learned that. But that's not enough of a definition. Because pure carbon, for instance, is carbon-containing, and it is not organic. The graphite that your pencil contains, which we erroneously call lead, has nothing to do with the element lead, is graphite. It's pure carbon. But it's not organic, even though it's made up of nothing but carbon. And all diamond is another example. Pure carbon. Not organic, though. So to be organic, it has to contain carbon, but it also has to be a compound, carbon and other stuff as well, other kinds of elements. Almost always there's hydrogen in there as well, but there's often oxygen and other compound, other atoms as well. Now, for historical reasons, there's even some exceptions to carbon-containing compounds, carbon-containing substances that are compounds. Almost all carbon-containing compounds are considered organic, but the important exception, there's very few exceptions, but the important exception in this course is carbon dioxide. That's not considered organic. Just about anything else, though, that contains carbon and other things, including hydrogen, is organic. And all of these examples in slide 2 are organic compounds. You can see that carbon is in each one of them, and so is hydrogen, and that's it. So even more specifically than saying all of these examples are organic, they are also all examples of hydrocarbons, which is a name that gives away what the thing is, right? Hydrocarbons are compounds that contain carbon and hydrogen only, no other types of atoms. Which is why you see only black and white balls in the ball and stick models. Now later we'll be talking about carbohydrates in addition. Don't confuse those two words. Carbohydrates have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Hydrocarbons have carbon and hydrogen only. So these are all hydrocarbons, and the only bonds, therefore, are between carbon and hydrogen or between carbon and carbon. Why don't you have any hydrogen-hydrogen bonds in a hydrocarbon? Right. It can only form one, so if it bonds to another hydrogen, that is a complete molecule. There's no carbon involved, right? So to be part of an organic compound with carbon in it, it has to be bound to carbon to make its one bond. Well, hydrocarbons make excellent fuels. They are energy-dense. Those carbon-hydrogen bonds are good sources of energy, which is why we use hydrocarbons as fuel sources outside of biology. Gasoline, for instance, is really just a mixture of a bunch of different hydrocarbons. Octane and hexane and things like those are hydrocarbons. They have a lot of fuel in them, a lot of energy in them, so it's a good fuel. But they're also, these carbon-hydrogen bonds are also rich sources of energy within cells, including our own bodies. And we'll be talking much more about that in Unit 3. But along those same lines, and the reason actually that they're good fuels, is that a carbon-hydrogen bond is nonpolar. What has to be true for a carbon-hydrogen bond to be nonpolar? What has to be true for a bond to be nonpolar? Yes, that's true, and therefore there is equal sharing. Nonpolar bonds are feature equal sharing of electron pairs, and the reason that happens, correct, is that the two atoms involved have about the same electronegativities, which is true for carbon and hydrogen. And so the fact that hydrocarbons, which are made of nothing but carbon and hydrogen, are nonpolar substances means they don't mix well in water, which is a polar substance. Polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things. But the two don't mix well. Okay, now, what is so special about carbon? Slide 3 tries to answer that. Carbon is an example of a tetravalent element, which is just a one-word way of saying that it has a valence of 4, because tetra means 4. Now, the 4 major nonmetals that make up all organisms, as we've said, are hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. They're all shown here. Other nonmetals are important in molecules as well, but these are the 4 biggies. And they differ in their valences, right? They're different number of steps from the right edge on the periodic table. Hydrogen has a valence of 1, and therefore, in any molecule it's part of, it's making 1 bond. Therefore, the only different ways that it can, the only variety that you can have in a bond involving hydrogen is that it can bond to different kinds of atoms, right? That's it for its variety. But carbon has tetravalence, and that gives it a lot more possibilities when it comes to being involved in molecules. Tetravalence means it has to make 4 overall bonds, but you can do that by making 4 single bonds that add up to 4, 2 double bonds, a triple bond, and a single bond. Those are all, that alone is a lot of variety, right? And then if you consider the only single bonds scenario, you can form 4 single bonds with 4 of the same thing, like methane, with 4 different hydrogens. 2 of one thing, 2 of another, 3 of one thing, 1 of another, or 4 different things, right? Plus similar variety when it comes to using double and triple bonds. So compared to the other nonmetals shown here, carbon has the most possible ways that it can form bonds. Now, carbon is not the only tetravalent element. What else on the periodic table is tetravalent? Silicon, germanium, all the ones in the same group, right? But what is special about carbon in that group? Well, you're overthinking it.
It's the smallest.
It's the smallest, yes. It's on the top of the list, right? It's the smallest tetravalent element. And because of that great variety and the fact that it's most common because it's of the tetravalent ones, because it's smallest, is why it's the basis of life. It's why we say we are carbon-based organisms. Slide 4 is a picture of a structural formula of an example of an organic compound. This one's not a hydrocarbon, obviously, right? There's not just carbon and hydrogen here. There's 2 things to say about this. It's a bit unusual because in most organic compounds that have hydrogen, which is most organic compounds, hydrogen is directly bound to carbon. It's not here, notice. Hydrogen's in there, but it's actually bound to nitrogens instead. But anyway, the main reason it's shown here in the slideshow is it's kind of historically important, urea, because it was the first organic compound that was successfully synthesized artificially, in other words, by using inorganic sources. And so that's when we proved that we'd been wrong all this time about thinking there's something special about organisms versus non-living things and the stuff they're made out of. First synthesized organic compound. And by the way, chemistry, to show you the importance of carbon, chemistry is a huge, huge science as the overall umbrella. But you can break it down into 2 also very huge subdivisions, which are organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. The chemistry involving carbon and everything else in chemistry. So it's a truly important atom. In 5, we're looking at a bunch of other hydrocarbons beyond the examples we've already looked at. Notice these are all just carbon and hydrogen. And the point of this slide is that if you have hydrocarbons, there's all kinds of different hydrocarbons, many, many. And so it's useful to classify them, and there's different ways of classifying them, more than just these 4 ways. But these 4 ways of classifying them are fundamentally different. Not one way of classifying them has nothing to do with the other way.
One way, though, is by the size or the length of what is called the carbon skeleton. In each of these examples, there's a certain number of carbons, and however many carbons there are, we call that collection of carbons the carbon skeleton. So you can think of an organic compound, whether it's a hydrocarbon or not, an organic compound as being the carbon skeleton and everything that's hooked to it, which are all the other non-carbon atoms. All right. So that what's highlighted in teal in all of these is the carbon skeleton. And hydrocarbons can differ in the size of their carbon skeleton. That's one way of classifying them. Notice these two words end in A-N-E, ethane and propane, because they are both examples of a general category called alkanes, which itself ends in A-N-E. Alkanes is a category, not a substance.
What about the
That's also an alkane. Alkanes, though, are alkanes only if only single bonds are in the molecule, no double or triple. And we name the individual alkanes with words that end in A-N-E to tell you they're alkanes. The F part means two. Meth means one, like in the methane that you built, one carbon. F means two, prop means three, but means four, and so on. We can also classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not they have double bonds. Well, if you have at least one double bond, you're by definition not an alkane. Instead, it's an alkene, just like butene and the two versions of butene here. But but, once again, means four carbons. But it's a butene, not butane, because it's not just single bonds. But since there are four carbons in the skeleton, there are two ways in which you can have a double bond in there. That's why there are two versions of butene. You can either have the double bond right in the middle or off to the side in either direction. So two butene and one butene are examples of isomers. Iso means same. What these things share is their chemical formula. Each of them has exactly the same number of carbons and exactly the same number of hydrogens, which is why you can't always tell what you're talking about by looking at the chemical formula. Isomers have identical chemical formulas, but they're not the same stuff. They interact with other things differently. Branching is another way we can classify these. Butane has four carbons, but it's linear arrangement. 2-methylpropane also has four carbons, so they have exactly the same chemical formula. They're isomers, but one of them branches and one of them doesn't in the skeleton. And then when all you have are four, there's only one possible way to branch it. 5 has more, 6 has many more, and every time you add another carbon, there become all kinds of different ways that you can branch, because you can multiply branch. So that's why hydrocarbons that have a lot of carbons in them, there's all kinds of different isomers of just that same chemical formula. And then finally, you can also classify them based on whether or not the carbon skeleton folds back on itself and bonds to form a ring, which not all of them do, obviously, but these two do. Okay, that's classification of hydrocarbons. Let's go to 6. Yeah. What about it? Well, you already have the pictures on the website.
It's easier to access.
Okay. I need to go on, though, because we're going to run out of time otherwise. 6 is a cartoon of a fat, as you see labeled here. Well, talk much more about fats in a chapter that surveys the four kinds of biological macromolecules. But a fat, as you can see, has three tails on it. If these tails were not all connected to this common part, if they were just by themselves, they would be called fatty acids. It takes three fatty acids to make up a fat, in other words. But a fatty acid, if you ignore the one end and just look at the yellow shaded part, if that were a molecule by itself, how would you classify it? What would you call that thing? What kind of molecule? Yellow shaded part.
Well, it is true, but what, based on what it's made out of? It's a hydrocarbon, right? Nothing but carbons and hydrogen. Now, there's oxygen at this end, but I told you we're ignoring that. So a fatty acid is almost a hydrocarbon. Almost all of its length is nothing but carbon and hydrogen. And just like gasoline, which is hydrocarbons, makes excellent fuel, fatty acids make excellent fuels. That's why we store our energy, our extra energy, as fats. You know, if we take we take in energy in the form of food. If we take in more than we actually use, whether it's by metabolism sitting there or by exercising, if we take in more energy than we need, we've evolved to not waste that extra energy, so we save it. But we save what, no matter what it comes in as, carbohydrate, protein, or fat, we're going to turn it into fat to store it, because that's much more efficient. And that's because of the energy density of fat. Fats have high energy density. The energy density is how much energy is contained in a gram of that stuff. And there's more than twice as much energy contained in a gram of fat than there is in a gram of carbohydrate or a gram of protein. So if we had to store our extra energy as carbohydrate or as protein, we would have to be bigger to do that, because it would take more of that stuff to contain that same amount of energy. Does that make sense? We would therefore weigh more and be harder to move around, which would be evolutionarily disfavored, right, by natural selection. So, you know, candy manufacturers love to say no fat, which is true, it's almost pure sugar, like a Jolly Rancher, for instance. But if we don't need those calories, we're going to turn all of that sugar into fat to store it. Okay, 7. More on isomers here. There's more than 3 ways to classify isomers, but in this course we're paying attention to 3 ways, which are shown by the 3 boxes. They're all isomers in all cases, but there's different kinds or categories of isomers. In each box you have a right and a left version. They are identical in their chemical formulae, that, in other words, they're isomers. But how their isomers are different in the 3 boxes. Structural isomers are different from each other just based on the different arrangement of their carbon skeletons. So you have one that's not branched, one that's branched, for instance. That's pretty straightforward. The middle category is called geometric isomers. Now notice that in the structural isomers, there's only single bonds there for those examples. And if you think back to your molecular modeling with the actual kits, it doesn't matter what atoms you use, it wouldn't have to be a hydrocarbon. Any atoms that you use, if you only have single bonds in it, each of those individual bonds you can swivel, right? So whatever is connected to it can swivel, right? They're not locked into position. Just like when you made your glucose, most of that glucose, which was almost all single bonds, could be swiveled, so you could make it different shapes. But think about when you use 2 springs to represent a double bond. You can't swivel those 2 atoms, at least not more than a little bit. And that's what geometric isomers are. They involve a double bond between 2 carbons. And therefore, the things that are connected to those carbons are locked into one position or another, depending on whether you make the double bond this way or this way. That's what the X's represent. They can be anything other than hydrogen. So they're either both on the same side of the double bond, or they are on opposite sides. And the 2 versions of geometric isomers are the cis isomer and the trans isomer. Cis meaning same side, trans meaning across or opposite side. Just like in cisgender and transgender, and other uses of those. So those are just for double bonds. And then we have the 3rd category down here, the enantiomers, which are examples of chiral compounds. We call the compounds chiral as an adjective, or we say that they have chirality, which means handedness. just like the hands of your body. That's why the hands are shown here. You know, if you think about your hands, they look almost identical. But they're not the same, right? They're mirror images of each other. So if you were able to safely remove your hands and play with them, move them around in space, there's no way that you could take your right hand and reposition it so that it is just like your left hand. Because they are mirror images of each other. They're not the same thing. And so they're chiral. They have handedness. Chiro means hand, as in chiropractor, for instance, someone who works on you with hands. Similarly, in molecules, if you have a carbon atom, which is tetravalent, of course, and it's making four single bonds like it can, and further, if all of those four things it's making are bonds with are different, so unlike methane's all the same thing, right? Here you have four different things, and it doesn't matter what they are, as long as they're all four different corners to the tetrahedron, then there's two versions you can make of that, which are mirror images of each other. And if you do this with ball and stick, there's no way that you can pick that model up and turn it around and make it into the mirror image. The only way you can do that is to break two of the bonds and swap them to make the other version. And they behave differently. They seem like they're the same molecule, but they're enantiomers. They're isomers of each other, and they therefore interact with things differently. Like as in the next couple examples. Slide 8 is a example of enantiomers using drugs, which remember are signal molecules. And keep in mind that signal molecules have no effect at all unless they bind to a receptor somewhere, right? Well, if it's a chiral signal, which means there's a left-handed version possible and a right-handed version possible, only one of those is going to work because the cell either has no receptors at all, in which case neither would work, or it has just one kind of receptor, either the right-handed version or the left-handed version. And it's not always the case that one version works and the other version doesn't. It's on a drug-by-drug basis. In the case of ibuprofen, the left-handed version works and the right-handed version doesn't because the left-handed receptors that we have, it's just the opposite for albuterol. The right-handed version works, the left-handed version doesn't work. By the way, these S's and R's is just one way to classify enantiomers. The S comes from a word sinistro as a prefix, but you could also have the adjective sinistral, which is very similar to the word sinister. The majority of humans are right-handed, so that we've kind of ganged up against the left-handed people of the world, including in the use of the invention of the word sinister, which literally means left-handed, but we use it in a way that say you have to be suspicious of that person because that person looks left-handed, which is unfair, of course, but that's just because most of us are right-handed. But that's what the S comes from, so the S... R notation, S is left-handed. R comes from recto, which means right. That's not the only notation we use for left and right, though. In slide 9, we can see the two versions of DOPA, L-DOPA and D-DOPA. And you see L's in front of a lot of drug names because a lot of drugs are chiral compounds. So it's possible to make either a left-handed version or a right-handed version. But if you make the wrong-handed version, it's a total waste of money as a drug company because it's not going to work. L, by the way, stands for levo, which means left. And D for dextro, same as in the word dexterous. We use the word dexterous to mean a person who's good with his or her hands, right? Well, it literally means right-handed, as though a left-handed person can't be good with his hands. So it's also disfavoring the left-handed people. The word ambidextrous means having two right hands, which is further disfavor. But anyway, let's go to 10. And to finish this chapter, we'll talk more now about functional groups that you were introduced to in the lab last week, and you should have studied by now, but I finally go over these with you. First, though, we're looking at two very similar structurally chemicals, estradiol and testosterone. Estradiol is an estrogen. Testosterone is radically different in its effect from estrogens. Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone, but they're very similar, notice. And as a matter of fact, they start out identical. These are just two of the several different steroid hormones that animals use. They all start out, though, as cholesterol, which is similar to both of these, and it just slightly gets modified. Slight modification makes a huge difference, though, because of these functional groups. The functional groups are the parts that are shaded in blue. Keep in mind that a functional group is not a molecule. It's not a complete molecule. It's a collection of atoms that are part of an overall molecule. And they're called functional groups because that particular arrangement of atoms gives the overall molecule a certain function that it wouldn't have without the functional group. It's the functional groups that makes for the different, drastically different effects of estrogens and testosterone. So let's survey the biologically important functional groups. These are the ones that you should have already studied from lab, but because we did that lab earlier than we usually do, you hadn't lectured yet. Each one of these has the name of the functional group, a cartoon of the ball and stick model, and a symbolic representation. Notice that the ball and stick and the symbol shows you that these are not complete molecules, right? There's a stick hanging off, so it's not a complete molecule. It's just part. Now, you could just draw it with a stick. For instance, this first one is hydroxyl. You could write that as dash OH, as it's shown. But you could also write it as R-OH, R standing for residue, which simply means the rest of the molecule, what's left over, in other words. Doesn't matter which side you write the R on, so this could be HO-R as well. That's still the same thing. It cannot, though, be OH-R. What's the problem with that? Right, but why is that impossible? Right, hydrogen's forming two bonds here. It can't do that, right? Only one. So that's wrong. The O is the one that has to go in the middle. It's forming two bonds. But anyway, a hydroxyl group is simply this OH with the O bonded to the residue. And we find them all over the place. Any compound that has a hydroxyl group somewhere in it makes it an alcohol. Alcohols are hydroxyl-containing compounds. So ethanol is an example of an alcohol, and alcohol names end in OL to tell you they're alcohols. That's the same alcohol that's in any alcoholic beverage, but that's just one of thousands of different alcohols. Sugars are alcohols, for instance, because they have hydroxyls just like the glucose that you built. And so they're important for that reason alone. They make up, their monosaccharides are hydroxyls, are alcohols, and they're important in biology. Carbonyl is next. A C double bonded to an O, but C is tetravalent, of course, so it has to make two more bonds, so there are two tails hanging off of it, two other connections it has to make to the residue, and therefore there's two possible ways for that to happen, illustrated in the two example pictures here. So there's not just one category of carbonyl-containing compounds, there's two, and those are called aldehydes and ketones. The only difference is how the carbonyl is connected to the rest. And I used to confuse these in my mind all the time, and one day it just dawned on me, helped me remember it, and hopefully it will help you, that A, as an aldehyde, is at the tip of the alphabet. Well, aldehydes are carbonyl-containing compounds in which the carbon that's part of the carbonyl is at a tip of the skeleton. It could be one of any number of tips if you have branching. But if it's at a tip, then it's an aldehyde. The only other possibility is that it's not at a tip. This one's not at a tip, right? So it's a ketone. Similarly, K, as in ketone, is not at the tip of the alphabet. It's in the middle. Well, next up is the carboxyl group, which confuses people when they're first learning these, like when you were doing the modeling last week. Because it looks like you have a carbonyl group there and a hydroxyl group, right? And technically you do, but we don't consider it to be either of those groups. When it's that particular arrangement, we consider the whole thing to be a carboxyl group. And there's no carbonyl and there's no hydroxyl. But notice that the word carboxyl is really just a portmanteau or combination of the two words, carbonyl and hydroxyl. So yes, it is, but we don't consider this to be either a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. Really important in biology because every building block of protein, the building blocks are called amino acids, has a carboxyl in it. So it's impossible to imagine organisms without proteins. They all use carboxyls. Similarly, in slide 12, the last slide, you have next up the amino group. And any time that you have the word amino or amine or amono, all of those with the AMs refer to nitrogen. You can see that an amino group features a nitrogen, has to make three bonds, of course. Two of them are with individual hydrogens, and the third one to the residue. But this is important for the similar reason as carboxyls. Each amino acid, which is what you make proteins out of, has an amino group and a carboxyl group. This is just one amino acid. You can see the amino group shaded here because we're in the amino column. But the other side of this is the carboxyl group. So no proteins without carboxyls or aminos, and therefore no life without those. Next up is the sulfhydryl group, which is SH, not OH. But it's otherwise very similar to a hydroxyl, right? It's just a sulfur instead of an oxygen. Now, why should it not be surprising that this could form SH instead of OH?
Same group.
Same group. Exactly why you used oxygen to represent sulfur in your modeling, right? They have the same valence. But what did I just say is the name of the category of compounds that contain hydroxyls?
Alcohols.
Well, things that contain a sulfhydryl are not alcohols because they don't have a hydroxyl. But they are called thiols, which ends in O-L, like alcohols do. Thio means sulfur. Just like amino means nitrogen, thio means sulfur. So the word literally means sulfur-like alcohol. It's not truly an alcohol, but it has similar properties because SH is very similar to OH in terms of group properties. When we talk more about proteins later, we'll see that certain amino acids, cysteine is shown here, have a sulfhydryl group in them. An overall protein is made of a bunch of amino acids, and if you have multiple amino acids in that overall protein that have sulfhydryl in them, the two sulfhydryl groups can get together, lose their hydrogens, and bond the sulfurs together covalently, which really stabilizes the shape, which is important in function of proteins, as I've said. It can keep them from changing shape. This happens a lot in hair, in mammals' hair, like our hair, which is why if you burn hair, either accidentally or for fun, it smells like sulfur. You're breaking those sulfhydryl bonds. Next up is phosphate, and it's the most complex of the ones we're studying in terms of the atoms involved, because there's five atoms, a central phosphorus atom, and four oxygens surrounding it. One of those oxygens is bound to the carbon skeleton, the residue. And there's at least three different reasons why this is absolutely indispensable to life. One is that the building blocks of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, are called nucleotides, and each individual nucleotide, to be a nucleotide, has to have a phosphate in it. So no DNA or RNA without phosphate, therefore no life, just for that reason alone. Also, without phosphate, you can't have ATP, which is the main energy-carrying molecule that cells use. The P in ATP stands for phosphate. That alone is reason enough that we can't live without it. Plus, phosphate is really important in a process called phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. To phosphorylate a protein means to stick a phosphate onto it. To dephosphorylate it means to rip that phosphate off of it. And this kind of acts like a molecular switch. So, for instance, an enzyme, which is one example of a protein, has a specific function to work as a catalyst. You can turn it on, activate it, or turn it off, either by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating it, rather than having to break it, totally digest it into atoms in order to keep it from working. You can keep it as a molecule, but just switch it off temporarily with this phosphate, dephosphorylation-phosphorylation mechanism. Yeah, it's spelled thus. Okay, that leaves just one, which is the methyl group. And then if you were taking an organic chemistry course, you would learn other groups as well, but these are the biggies for biology. Methyl groups you tend to find a lot of places when you're looking at structural formulae, like when you were circling them in the handout, right? There's a bunch of methyls, particularly at the tips of carbon skeletons, because every carbon that's at a tip, if it's forming only one bond with the skeleton, that leaves three more bonds it has to make. The easiest way to do that is just to fill it up with three hydrogens. So there's methyls all over the place. And they can also act as little switches, just like phosphate. You can methylate and demethylate also. And this is how cells can turn genes on or off. The genes are always there. Genes are what are transcribed in the process of transcription I talked about as a way of making a protein. The first step is to make RNA using the information in DNA. But every cell has all the genes. You never want it to be the case that any individual cell is going to use all of those genes. You don't want toenails to be growing in the liver. It has the possibility because it has those genes, but you want a lot of them to be turned off. And the way that you can turn off genes semi-permanently is to methylate them. So that's just one important thing in biology. And I don't think there's anything after that. Oh, yeah, there is. 13, which, speaking of ATP, just shows you this. So we'll have much more to say about ATP in the energy unit, but you can just see here that ATP is made up of three phosphates. It's adenosine triphosphate. You have adenosine, which could be a molecule by itself, but if you triply phosphorylate it, you have ATP. The details of that will be important later, but let me just alert you to the fact that P with a circle around it is shorthand for a phosphate group. That does not mean a phosphorus atom. There's still four oxygens around each of these P's. They're just not shown for shorthand. So if you see a P by itself, that's a phosphorus atom. If you see a P with a circle around it, that's a phosphate group with a phosphate atom and four oxygen atoms around it. But that is enough for today and for this unit. Therefore, come with a Scantron and knowledge of all these four chapters. I'll see you in the laboratory.